good.
It's very interesting hearing talks recorded and downloading them from the from Free Buddhist Audio, talks that one's given oneself. They never sound anything like you think you're going to sound. They always sound not as good, really. I do actually enjoy giving talks. I don't always enjoy writing them. But I really love giving them to two people or 2,000. I've done both. And I don't enjoy writing them because I get some kind of writer's block. It just doesn't flow. The ideas, the Dharma doesn't really flow, the thoughts. So what I usually do is I try and unblock myself with some kind of memory, some memory of my experience or practice in the Dharma. And that sort of unblocks the block. And that happened this time as well. So this time I thought I sort of went into some memories of some near-death experiences that I've had in my life. Quite a kind of traumatic unblocking, isn't it? But it's okay. We're adults. We're all grown up. I think we can handle it. I thought I would tell you a little bit about that, really. I'm mainly going to talk about some near-death experiences. I had a little short window of my life in my late teens where there's a three-year period of foolish youth. Between the ages of 17 and 20, I did some quite dangerous things, actually. What did I do? I fell 60 foot down a scree slope cliff in the Lake District on a mountain and nearly died. I thought I was going to die when I was falling, but I wasn't. I was knocked out in a boxing club, in an amateur boxing bout in Carlisle in 1979. I was knocked out for over a minute before they could revive me. And whilst I was knocked out, I thought I was dead. Also, I had various motorcycle accidents, and some of them were pretty traumatic. I started off with small accidents and then moved on to sort of much more major affairs, really. And the really big one was the Storrs Park motorcycle accident in Windermere in the Lake District. I grew up in Windermere, this huge big lake in the middle of the Lake District. I was very lucky, really, because our house was quite close to the shores of Lake Windermere. But when I was 18, my friends and I lived for speed. We lived for speed. So even though I'd become a Buddhist at the age of 14, that wasn't an integrated going for refuge. I wasn't entirely integrated at the age of 18. There were other pulls on my interest in life at that time, and one of them was motorcycling. And I was so keen on it, my friends and I were also keen, that we used to go out at night. We used to go out at midnight because there weren't any cars around in Cumbria. The country lanes in Cumbria at midnight and between midnight and 2 o'clock. So that's when we used to go out, and we used to tune our bikes obsessively. We would don our black leathers, put our helmets on and everything, and our motorcycle boots, and our highly tuned motorcycles were like the sword that we thrust deep into the midnight heart of the Cumbrian countryside, swerving, accelerating, braking, twisting and turning, overtaking each other in an orgy of adrenaline and speed. We loved it. We absolutely loved it. We used to psych ourselves up before these bouts with listening to Stairway to Heaven before we went out. And some of you might be familiar with that particular piece of music. And then we went out and rode. And the main thing was about skill and speed, trying to go as fast as possible. We treated the Cumbrian countryside like a racetrack, like Brands Hatch, which was, of course, very irresponsible and dangerous thing to do. So I feel deeply ashamed about that sometimes when I think about what could have happened to other people. But that's what we did. And it was all going very well until I got to the age of 18, when I came to, we were going just outside Lake Windermere, we just set off And we came to this little corner here. I found it, the wonders of the internet. I haven't seen it for 30 years. But I found this little corner, just a fairly innocuous A road with a corner, which any sensible person would take at about 50 miles an hour. But we were already accustomed to taking this corner at 70 miles an hour, breaking the speed limit, of course. But the idea came about that we would try and take it about 1 o'clock in the morning at 80 miles an hour. That was the idea. So we set off and we were ready, we were prepared. And I was the first into the corner. And I was right down behind the speedo. I banked into the corner. And I suddenly realised that something was wrong. I wasn't going to make it. I wasn't going to make it round the corner. But I knew that there was quite a vicious looking set of iron railings near a meadow. So that's where I ended up. So there's a meadow. It's a very boggy meadow. And all I really remember is thinking, oh my goodness, this is it. And then I remember just being in the air and flying for what seemed like, they say, you know, when you're about to die or have an accident, time stands still. Well, it did. It really was like that. And after that, I don't really remember anything until waking up in an ambulance. When I was in an ambulance, I remember feeling that the whole of my backside and my back was wet and cold. Of course, I'd been lying in a muddy field for the half hour that it took for the ambulance to come. I had a fractured skull and a broken leg. Lots and lots of my bike cartwheeled down the road and burst into flames and set the road on fire. So it's quite a dramatic hit. And what seemed to concern me more than anything else was that my friend was in the ambulance with me and he was crying, and I'd never seen that before, because at that point they thought I was going to die. But I didn't die. I was just knocked out. So that event changed my life. It was a very close brush with physical death. Looking back, I was immature. I was an immature person. I was unintegrated. Yeah, I lacked integration. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just playing for kicks. Also, I lacked training. I wasn't a particularly good rider, I think, looking back. I hadn't really had much training. I thought I was good, but I wasn't really. I lacked training. And since that time, I mean, I'll tell you a bit more about this. I've learned many, many lessons from that particular incident. And one of them is the whole benefit, the value of training. So thinking back over my 55 years, I've trained in quite a lot of things, actually. As a kid, I obviously trained to go to bed early at night. I trained to use a knife and fork as a kid. I learned to spell correctly, well, mostly anyway. And, well, I did also go to art college and learn illustration, drawing and painting. I had a career as a graphic designer. More recently, I've been learning Iyengar yoga again in my 50s. Dhyanpati's been teaching me Iyengar yoga, and I'm getting the benefits of all that. So training's a really important thing in my life, continues to be very important. I also feel I'm very well trained in the Dharma. I really do. I'm stood here now, 41 years in the Dharma, and I feel very well trained in meditation. Trained a lot in meditation, I think. Ritual and devotion. Study and study leading. I did an 11-year sort of training course in leading study groups. I've trained in working in Right Livelihood and Right Livelihood businesses. And spiritual friendship. I think I've trained quite a lot in Kalyana Mitrata and Sangha building and maintaining and even developing. So I feel I've trained in all these things. In the last 10 years, I've been training in ordination and ordaining people. So I don't wish to trumpet my own achievements such as they are. I'm really saying all this because I'm so enormously grateful for the training that I've received within Tri Ratna. I'm very, very grateful indeed. I think it's been remarkable, the training that I've received. I think without it, my Dharma life would have crashed. Just like my motorcycle, I would have just crashed into the meadow of whatever. So I'm very, very grateful. There's been effort and will on my part, of course, but mostly it's been the kindness, generosity and guidance of men and women in the order. So my main teacher and trainer, if you like, has been Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita's been the main trainer for me, but also many, many men and women within the Triyatan order have trained and guided me. And that's what happens in the Sangha. In the Sangha, you get training. In the Sangha, you get people there to guide you and help you and catch you when you fall, or even prevent you from going off track completely. So spiritual community is very much the theme of this series that we've been looking at. We've had talks on, so this is the final talk. So we've already heard about integration from Samanathi, how we've got to bring ourselves together, all the different parts of ourselves together to go for refuge. We've heard about positive emotion from Parami and how essential that is to go for refuge and build spiritual community. We've also heard on Wednesday about spiritual receptivity from Sangadevi. So tonight I'm going to talk about spiritual death and rebirth in the spiritual community. And I've got two stages to talk about. They only had one stage. I've got two to talk about. So I need to get on with that, actually, because time is moving on. One of the trainings of learning to give talks is to get it over on time and get your points in exactly for the right time. I've had to train in that, because if your audience feels that you've lost it, it's a horrible feeling, isn't it? You sat there and you're thinking, well, he's not even started yet. There's half an hour gone. How long is this going to be? It's a horrible feeling. I've been there. So, yeah, Ramakosha did say that the five stages were originally talked about in terms of meditation. And it's a very good system of meditation, traditional system that we've got. But also, the five stages is talked about in terms of a path of spiritual training. So that means methods. Methods that we actually use, like the five precepts. So in Triratna, we do have a training. We have a context. We have a spiritual community. We have a teacher. We are disciples. We are disciples of the Buddha. So these are the great stages of the spiritual path. So I'm going to say a bit about spiritual death and rebirth now. I'm going to just plunge into my subject. So the word death is a metaphor in this context. And it's a very powerful metaphor because physical death is such a powerful fact within our own lives. In Buddhism, we reflect quite a lot on death, and particularly our physical death, and that's very useful to us in terms of our practice. Because it's something that we all share, it's going to happen to every one of us at some point. It's like a parcel that's got your address on it. It's been stamped, and it's in the post. It's coming to you. It's going to be delivered like an Amazon parcel, but you don't know when that's going to be delivered. So reflection on death is a powerful practice because it gets us to look at our lives and how we're living our lives and the values of our lives. The practice isn't there to frighten us. It's not designed to make us depressed. That's the last thing it's there for. It's actually there to make us more alive to our practice, more ethically skillful in our lives. So if you really accept death, you really accept the fact of death, then you'll live differently. You'll live your life in a different way. So physical death is the end of our lives. What happens after that? We don't know. We actually don't know. We know what the Buddha taught. We know what Buddhism says. But really, there's a very, very big question mark about what happens after we die. Something ends, but we don't know what comes next. So So, according to the Buddhist tradition, your karma, your action in this life, creates a new life. But it's not going to be exactly like this one. But there'll be some kind of relationship between the two. You have death, and you have rebirth. So, but actually, when you think about it, we're dying all the time. So, one of my little interesting sort of gothic habits is I'm quite interested in death masks. I know that sounds a bit creepy, but it's actually not really. I like looking at death masks of artists like Turner and Constable, Kings and Queens. I've travelled quite a distance to see some of those. Anyway, recently I came across a death mask of a young woman that had fallen in the River Seine in Paris in 1898. So, prepare yourselves. I think it's quite beautiful, actually. I think she looks very, very serene. We don't know whether she was or what happened, but no one knew. She probably committed suicide, they thought. But it's quite a famous mask, death mask, actually. It's called L'Inconnu de la Seine. It's known as. And if you get a chance, have a look at death masks. Well, that's going to be us. That's what's going to happen to us somewhere along the line in our life. And we need to reflect on that from time to time in a creative way. Spiritual death is a bit different from that. We can also reflect on spiritual death in a different way from physical death. But in a way, the process is the same. Things are ending and things are beginning all the time. So when we travel, we set off on our journey, we're dying to where we've just come from. We're here on a Saturday night, and ourselves on the Friday night has died. And tomorrow, some of you may come to Sangha Day, and this talk will be dead. Hopefully you won't forget it, but it'll be dead. That part of you that was here then won't be here now. And there's nothing that doesn't come to an end, yeah? Everything comes to an end. From mountains to molecules. Everything changes. From Kit Kats to Kindles. From orangutans to oceans. Everything comes to an end. Everything changes. And when it comes to an end, that creates a space for something new to arrive in its place. That's what's just going on all the time. You can observe it in nature. You look at the seasons. You can look in the mirror. So in our Dharma lives, we also die. Our lesser selves, you could say, die to a greater self, a new self. We're dying all the time in our Dharma lives. Sometimes if you dig out your diary, your retreat diary from several years ago or even decades ago, and you read what you were thinking and saying, and how you're viewing things, it's all quite different now. I remember I burned my Gukkha-loka diary 10 years after I was ordained, and I don't know why I burned it, really. I kind of regret that now, because I think when I read it 10 years after, I thought, oh my goodness, sort it out, come on. The way that I was expressing, I'd moved on quite a long way. I should have felt good about that, but for some reason I felt embarrassed. So this death and rebirth is born out in a particular hero of mine, spiritual hero of mine, which is Dr. Ambedkar. I think most of you will know the story about Dr. Ambedkar, how he was born into a lower caste in Hinduism in India. And, in 1956 he left that. His old self died. And he converted to Buddhism. And along with several hundred thousand followers, later to be millions of followers, that was the event in 1956, October 1956, an enormous event. He led, in the end, millions of people into Buddhism. So their old selves died, and a new self was born. What he said, Dr. Ambedkar actually said after he made the conversion, he said, "I feel like I've been released from hell. I feel I've been reborn." So he initiated the rebirth of a Buddhist movement in the rebirth of Buddhism, really, in India at that particular time, in the modern time, and that still goes on. He described himself at the time as a human being with the destiny of a Buddha. A human being with the destiny of a Buddha. And this is what we mean by spiritual death. This is us realizing that you're a human being with the potential destiny of a Buddha. And letting go of that lesser idea of yourself, that you, and embracing the fact that you could become more and more like the Buddha. That's if you train. It means letting go of a fixed view of yourself. Fixed view is one of the problems. We sometimes get a rigid, hard view of what we think we are. We have so many false ideas about ourselves, about the kind of person that you are. You think, well, no, I don't do that. I'm not that kind of person. That's not me. I have to do this only. That's the way we sometimes think of ourselves. And we identify ourselves through our social status. We identify ourselves as through our class, our job, our education, our age. It just happens. It's bred into us in our society. We can identify as being a mother, or a father, a son or a daughter, a colleague, a husband, a manager, a student. Yeah. But, and these are all true. They may well be true. But we're much more than this. We can identify ourselves as being British, or Irish, or Indian, or Spanish. And when we meet other nationalities, we feel our own national identity. But we're much more than this. Sometimes we identify ourselves with our gender, and we think, well, I'm a guy, and this is what guys do, and you're a woman, and that's what women. It's all very narrowing. It's all very limiting. And we're much more than that. So it's okay as a description to have this, but it's fixed. It limits you. And parents really have to watch out for this, because when their children grow up, sometimes parents can carry on treating their kids as if they're still children. And similarly, when children grow up, they have to be careful that they don't do that with their parents. They actually realise that their parents are they're not who they thought they were. I had an experience of this with my father when my mother died in 2006. My father quite quickly found himself a new partner, quite quickly. And my brother was very, very upset about it, because there she was with Dad. There he was in his, what was, late 70s there, and he looked very happy, but he wasn't with our mother. And I had to say to my brother, look, it's okay, who we think of as Dad, there's more to him than that, actually. He can be another kind of person, and this is just showing that. It's interesting, recently I bought a little tablet, one of these tablets, you know, quite a cheap one, and I was telling my son, he said, what, you've bought a tablet, Dad? You've bought a tablet? And I said, yeah, you know, what's wrong with that? But, so, yeah, I mean, this is fixed identity, isn't it? He just couldn't believe that I would have done that. I think if my own dad bought a tablet, I think I'd fall off my chair. So letting go is so important. We have to let go of the fixed identity, because it goes very deep in us. And the Buddha taught that this fixed identity problem, it's a very big problem, actually. And it lies behind a lot of our other attachments. This fixed view of the I. Yeah, this thing called the I. It becomes our main interest in life. Looking after number one. And who's number one? I am. I'm number one. But then you're all probably thinking, no, you're not, I'm number one. This is part of the problem. We all think that we're number one. So that causes a lot of the problems in the world. And this attachment to I is where the problems come from. And we work to make sure that that I, that fixed I, isn't threatened. We surround ourselves with things which make that I secure. And that's what we call craving. We're trying to get things that will keep us safe and sound, safe and secure. And we push away things which threaten that. But of course, there is no safety and security, ultimately. Yeah. There's another tactic that we use as well, which is ignorance. We try to pretend that we haven't seen something, that it's not really there. A bit like a set of blinkers that you see on a horse. Yet we refuse to look at things that threaten that sense of fixed eye. And of course, we don't want to look at death. We don't want to look not just physical death, but the ending of our laptop. This happened to me about a year ago. I turned the beloved laptop on, and it went like that. And I was so upset. And I took it into work. I showed it to visitor. He took one. Nah, that's it. That's it. It's over. Get another one. And he gave me an advert for a new one. You know, it's just as simple as that. That's it. It's ended. But it hadn't ended for me. It took me a few days, actually, to come to terms with the fact. And I had to have a bit of a dig into the finances. And it's like, there goes my savings. And, I was quite attached. I didn't expect it at all. So this is the kind of thing that happens. And whatever security we get, we will eventually lose. And in this way, we try to build security in our lives through quite bad tactics. And the Buddha said that this is one of the basic reasons for our dissatisfaction, our unhappiness. We don't really understand ourselves and who we are. We've got a false idea of who we are. We see it as something fixed and eternal. It's not that we haven't got an identity, we have. But it's changing. So a lot of Buddhist practice is directed towards getting rid of this fixed, eternal self. If you can let go of this fixed self, you will experience a lot of freedom. It will have the taste of freedom. There won't be any craving. There won't be any hatred. You'll see things as they really are, and you're completely at ease. So this is what the Buddha did underneath the Bodhi tree. He saw through fixed self, and he let go of his attachment to I. He could still function in the world, of course. He could still go and get his breakfast if he wanted it. But he didn't see, for him, going to get breakfast in a fixed way. So this is a lot of what we're doing in Tree Ratna. This is a lot of what the Sangha is about in Tree Ratna. It's helping us to go beyond our fixed selves. I think what a lot of people often experience in Buddhist centres, coming to a Buddhist centre like this one, is they feel they can relax. They feel they can be themselves. They can open up to others. Because in Buddhist centres within the Sangha, people aren't so bothered about status. They're not so bothered about how much money you've got. They're not so bothered about where you went to school, or how old you are, or what colour. People are less bothered about those sorts of things. It's all a lot more loose. And that's a real relief, I must say. A real relief. But there's many practical ways that we can loosen up this self-identity. And one of these, of course, is serving others. Helping others. Working for the benefit of others. And the spiritual community provides loads of opportunities to do that. I don't need to enumerate them. The second way, of course, is a deeper communication with people. In that closer communication that you can have in spiritual friendship within the Sangha, something, the fixed part of you that is attached, can start to get loosened up. Stops being so concerned with all that. So, in the spiritual community, we can go beyond fixed self, fixed identity. And we get help with that in the spiritual community. We get training to do that. Also, we challenge each other sometimes. We might say, Ratna Gosha, I don't think that's true. I think you really could do that, actually. You've never done it before, but I think you could. And we encourage people to go beyond themselves and do what they haven't done before. Also, we can inspire each other. The spiritual community is where inspiration happens. And when that happens, we feel quite different. Had a really interesting experience of this recently on Dr. Ambedkar Day. I led Dr. Ambedkar Day, and Padmavajra came and he gave a talk. And not an unusual thing. I mean, I've sat through a lot of talks Padmavajra's given. But I watched myself and something happened to my whole experience. I realised that I was feeling very inspired. I went on for days and days afterwards and I ended up listening to quite a few talks, downloading talks. And he has that effect upon me. And he doesn't have it on everyone, but there's usually somebody within the spiritual community that has that effect. It elicits something. And when you're in that condition, things are very different. There is a feeling of freedom. So this is the spiritual community. Meditation, of course, is another way that we can loosen up this fixed self and go beyond the I. And there are strong practices within the Sangha, usually done by order members only. Not always, but usually. Usually on the basis of a lot of shamatha meditation. You need to be in a very good mental state, a healthy, happy human being, before you go into the recollection of the six elements, recollection of impermanence, recollection of shunyata, death, the nidana chain, all these kinds of practices. And these are all there, really, to help us to look for a fixed self. Within those practices, you're looking for a fixed self, and of course you don't find one. You don't find a fixed self. And that convinces us more deeply of this particular truth, Dharma truth. Subhuti tells a very good story about when he was a little boy. Apparently he lived in a very big old creaky house. And he was a little boy, and he was the youngest in the family, so he had to go to bed early. And he went up these creaky old stairs, and go up this in this old house, which apparently wasn't very well maintained, he told me. And he'd go to bed, and he picked up this idea from school that there were ghosts in the house. There were all these ghosts. And he got very, very frightened as a young boy. And he'd go into the bedroom, run into the bedroom, pull the covers over him like this, and lie there very, very frightened. And anyway, his father used to come up and see him after about half an hour just to make sure he was settled down. And he'd say, "Look, what are you doing under the bed? What's the matter?" He said, "There's a ghost. There's a ghost in the room. I'm frightened." And it's interesting, his father didn't say, "No, there isn't a ghost. Don't be foolish," which is what my father used to say. He said, "Oh, really? There's a ghost in the room. Where is it?" He said, "Well, it's behind the curtains." He said, "No, there's no ghost here behind the curtains. It's under the bed." So he looked, no, there's no ghost here. It's in the drawers. And no, there's no. And eventually, Subhuti would sort of settle down and be less frightened and realise there wasn't really a ghost there at all. It was all in his imagination. So I thought that was quite creative of his father. Similar thing happened with my own son, and I used to do this with him, and eventually he would settle down. So that's what we're doing a lot of the time. We're looking for the ghost, and we firmly believe it exists, but it doesn't. We're looking for a fixed self in all the places that a fixed self could possibly be. And if we don't find it, there's real evidence there. We become convinced. And that's the practice. So where would we look for a fixed self? Where would we look for the ghost if we were doing that? We wouldn't look under the bed. We'd look for it in all the places where we regularly experience ourselves. According to the Buddhist tradition, this is, of course, the five skandhas, or heaps. So I'm not going to enumerate them, I'll just tell you what they are. So obviously there's form, our physical body, the hard stuff, the earth. There's our feeling, vedana, pleasure, pain or neutral. We'll look for a fixed self in feeling. Or we can look for it in our perception, sanya, our intelligence, the way that we handle concepts and patterns, how we interpret the world. We can look for a fixed self there. But of course we can't find one, it's always changing. And then there's volitions, those drives and desires which make us want to do things. Finally, there's discriminating consciousness, vijnana. Yeah, our awareness itself. Yeah, this awareness that allows us to know our experience, that discerns. And we kind of switch this off sometimes at night. We're able to switch it off at night, but then it switches back on again when we wake up. But actually, there's no fixed self there either. So we can look for the ghost in the bedroom. This is one of the practices, but we won't find a fixed self. So I'm not going to go into the skandhas in any real detail here now. But my main point is that fixed self can't be found here. So the skandhas are described as everything that human beings can actually be made of, can experience, can exist with. And sometimes, well, Buddhists do these practices and they experience a lot of liberation. And sometimes this stage of spiritual death, if you like, is called insight. We call it insight. Sometimes breaking through stream entry, seeing things as they really are. And this would be spiritual death proper. But in a way, we don't really need to concern ourselves too much with that. As I've said, we're dying and being reborn all the time. And we're doing this on ever deeper and deeper levels. It's quite fashionable sometimes in the spiritual community to make claims, spiritual claims about yourself, a way that you've broken through in some way. And quite a lot of folk are convinced that that has happened to them. Well, that's jolly good, as far as it goes. But I do think it's a bit unwise, actually. I think it misleads people. And also, of course, you may well be wrong. You might be deluded. If you had actually gained insight, you probably wouldn't need to tell people about that or want people to know particularly about it. It would just show, perhaps very subtly, in your behaviour. So, spiritual rebirth. I should say something about that before I conclude. Before you do that, I thought I'd show you a photograph of myself 30 years ago. And I was thinking, when I looked at the photograph, what is my connection with this picture, this person? You know, it's me, but there isn't a molecule of my body that's the same as this here. There's a sort of pattern. There isn't my mind. There isn't... I don't know what there is. There isn't even a name, actually. The name's changed since that time, so... What is it? So, but nonetheless, there is a photograph of someone that was me. This is exactly 30 years ago. I was 25. I mean, you can sort of see it's me, can't you? But, you know, there you go. But it's not me. You know, that wasn't me, really. But then it was. So things aren't fixed, are they? I wouldn't go back to being that person for all the money that Richard Branson has, you know. So having died spiritually, we're reborn. And that's essentially a joyful experience. It's worth remembering that spiritual rebirth is joyful. Yeah, it's mysterious and beautiful. And this is best represented in the figure of the Buddha. He was a human being like us, but he became a lot more than that. And he went beyond us. He's close to us, but he went beyond us. And, well, there's a value for Buddhists in going on pilgrimage. If you ever get a chance to go on a pilgrimage, you can really connect with that in quite a strong way. If you go to Bodh Gaya or somewhere like that, the places of the Buddha, you can see a descendant of the tree that the Buddha actually sat underneath and where he gained enlightenment. He let go of this fixed eye. And you can see the Ashokan slab, which marks the exact spot. So there he was. There was the Buddha sat underneath the tree. That was the tree of enlightenment and the Bodhi tree. And if you ever get the chance to go there, it's quite a strong experience because it doesn't actually look like that now. It looks like that. it's a lot of what it looks like. Has anybody been there? Has anybody? Yeah, a few folk have been there. The Amputee and I went there this year, and we found it a really wonderful experience to sit there, to do puja. But what's so good about pilgrimage is you realise, in another way, that it really happened. We know that the Buddha gained enlightenment, we believe that, but that you go to see the exact spot where he actually broke through. And that has a very strong effect upon you. It really did happen. A human being really did gain liberation. You can also go up to this place called Grudarakuta, to the Vulture's Peak. And you can see the mountainside, go up onto the mountain. We walked all the way to the top. You see all the little caves where all the monks and nuns lived in the caves. The disciples of the Buddha, where the Buddha preached, taught the Dharma, walked up and down, lived for many years. And you can sense that when you're there. You can feel it. It's not just your imagination, good as that is. You can really sense it. And pilgrimage at its best can give us a strong, deep sense of the Buddha, of this spiritual rebirth. But maybe, you know, you can't go on pilgrimage. Maybe you haven't got money, maybe you're not well enough to go on a pilgrimage. So what can you do? How can you experience the Buddha in this kind of deeper way? Well, for 2,000 years now, it seems, Buddhists from all over the world have been engaging what's called Buddhanusmriti, or Buddhanusati, visualizing or revisualizing the Buddha, and remembering his qualities, revering the Buddha, engaging with the Buddha, imagining the Buddha. And this is what we do in something called the Tiratnavandana. I'm sure you all know this. We're often chanting. The chanting of the Tiratnavandana is essentially a Buddhanusmriti. You're visualizing the Buddha and his qualities. I must say, when you're at Buddh Gaya, you can often encounter Thai monks and nuns circumambulating, chanting the Tiratnavandana, and it's almost like an ethereal experience. It's so beautiful. It's so evocative of the life of the Buddha. After the Buddha's death, there were no images of the Buddha for about 400 years. There was just a kind of space somewhere on their shrines. And eventually, the Buddha was represented by stupas, by the Bodhi tree, by a wheel, sometimes by footprints. But gradually, images started to appear of the Buddha in the recognized form. And as the different schools of Buddhism developed, these images of enlightenment, the enlightenment started to develop and become represented in all kinds of different ways. And eventually you ended up with what's called the Mandala of the Five Buddhas. Some of you might be, you'd be pretty familiar with them. So we've got Virocha here, the white Buddha, the illuminator. And he's got a lion throne there. So, Virochana. He's in the centre of the mandala. And you also have the Buddha, Ratnasambhava, the golden Buddha. And he's got horses on his throne. You've also got the Buddha, Akshobhya, the imperturbable. And of course, his animal is the elephants, which can't be messed around with. Well, they all represent different aspects of the enlightened mind, different aspects of wisdom. We have a Movasiddhi, the green Buddha. Yeah, unobstructed success. And he's got strange creatures here, half human, half bird, Shang Shangs, a Movasiddhi. And finally, we have Amitabha, the Buddha of love, boundless light, the red Buddha of the Western Quarter. And his animal is a peacock. It's peacocks on the throne. So we get used to these images, and we've got Bodhisattva images, like Tara, female type images like Tara. And we're very familiar with these images. We see them all the time in Sangha. That's one of the benefits of the Sangha, is these images are around all the time. But do we really see them?
a lot of the time we don't. They become just part of the furniture. So it's quite a good little practice sometimes to just stop and really look at one of these images, because it represents spiritual rebirth. Perhaps you don't particularly relate to these images. Perhaps these images are, there isn't a problem with over familiarity. You just don't like the look of them at all. I've experienced this a bit in my work in India. In On the Shrine, you only ever see three things. You see the Buddha, you see a picture of Dr. Ambedkar, and you see a picture of Bhante Sangharakshita. It's usually only the ever one picture of Bhante Sangharakshita, a particular one at Padmaloka. And you always see that. You see that from the slums of Bombay to retreat centres. You don't see Bodhisattvas, because for them, it's too reminiscent of Hinduism, which is what they're trying to get away from. But when I first started working there, I really missed the Bodhisattvas. I noticed, I got used to the simplicity and beauty of the shrine, but I missed the Bodhisattvas, because they're such an important part of the spiritual life for us. But maybe you don't, you're not particularly attracted to these figures. Maybe they're quite difficult for you. Well, don't worry, please don't worry about that, because any connection that you have with one of these figures is a good thing. Even being irritated by some of the figures, you think, well, why is he holding that stupid staff or that mad act? That's a connection. That's a doorway in to the transcendental path. So these figures are a doorway. They're the Arya Sangha, and they represent the Bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, that remarkable transcendental force alive in the universe that can manifest through beings. But that's a whole other talk, and I'm not going to talk about that now. I'm going to wind up. So this Bodhicitta, represented by these figures, is said to be a bit like the wind. So recently Sangharakshita wrote a poem called The Wind, which he said just came to him, and he wrote it down perfectly formed in his mind. So I thought I would read it out to you. The wind was in my sails, it blew, stronger and fiercer hour by hour. I didn't know from whence it came or why, I only knew its power. Sometimes it dashed me on the rocks, sometimes it spun me round and round. Sometimes I laughed aloud for joy, sometimes I felt a peace profound. It drove me on, that manic wind, when I was young, it drives me still. Now I am old, it lives in me, its breath my breath, its will my will. So the joy, that joy of the Bodhicitta, of spiritual rebirth, is a bit like the wind. It can pick us up and spin us around and have us laughing out loud in that kind of way. I can't say that's happened to me, but I have felt a puff of that wind on occasions, particularly when I've done a long tour working in India, in retreat centres, meeting people, program after program, night after night, working away. And I get onto the aeroplane in Delhi Airport and we taxi out the runway to go out to the sky. I sometimes feel a sense of satisfaction, which I've never felt in any other context, quite like it. That feels like a bit of a puff of that wind in some way. Actually, thinking about it, some of the strongest moments I've had in relation to the spiritual community have been around Buddhist centres. Things like Sangha Day. I really feel it on Sangha Day. I really feel it in pujas and on conventions. I always go to the pujas. I really feel that wind kind of blowing through. I feel it. And in the midst of the puja, talking deeply with a good friend, or a crucial moment in a Dharma study group, I can feel it. And of course, I feel it around the area of ordination. If I'm conducting ordinations, and I felt it at my own ordination. I also feel it leaving retreats in India. It's quite funny, in India, when a retreat ends, people don't just hug each other and leave. They cry. Everybody cries in India. Everybody. And it's a sort of mass crying event as everybody's leaving. And it takes ages and it's so emotional. And that's just the men. It's so emotional. But it's also a lovely feeling. It's completely uninhibited. People, they're crying as they get onto the bus and they're waving, they're looking at... It really matters to them. And yes, and even I'm crying. So, the spiritual community, spiritual death and rebirth are all inextricably linked. The Sangha is the place where you can let go of a fixed identity and experience freedom. It encourages that here in the spiritual community. The Sangha is where you can intensify your spiritual practice through Kalyana Mitrata, retreats, festivals and friendship and meditation. So these are the places. The Sangha is also where the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are to be found. The Sangha is a place, the spiritual community, where guidance and training can be found from generous people. So I thought I'd just give you 5 practical questions to ask yourself before I conclude. Not just about spiritual death and rebirth, but about the whole schema, the whole 5 stages of integration, positive emotion, spiritual receptivity, and death and rebirth. Really, what it comes down to is 5 little reflections that you can ask yourself. Here they are. Am I becoming more mindful in everything I do? That's one question you can ask yourself as often as you like. Number 2, am I becoming more loving and positive? Number 3, am I staying in touch with my spiritual vision? Number 4, am I bringing what I realised to all aspects of my life? And finally, am I helping others as best I can? So these are the 5 things to really focus on. This is where the rubber hits the road. So I think I'm going to wind up now with some lines from Shantideva, the Bodhicharyavatara, which for me beautifully and perfectly sum up everything that I've been talking about in the area of spiritual death and rebirth. So, bearing in mind spiritual receptivity, please make yourself receptive. You've just got another minute, and I'll shut up. But just really drink in the words and their import. Something might happen. Today, my birth has borne fruit, and my humanity has been fulfilled. Today, I am reborn in the Buddha family, and I am now a son of the Buddha. And I must live up to my birth, and by my actions must place no stain upon that spotless family. Just as a blind man may find by chance a priceless jewel in a heap of refuse, so, somehow, this bodhicitta is hidden even in me. It is the elixir of life, which destroys all death, the destroyer of all. A limitless treasure to destroy all poverty, the supreme cure for the world's sickness. It is a tree of rest for the wearied world, wandering on the road of being. It is a bridge for all travellers, passing over the waters of suffering. It is the heart's waxing moon, cooling the heat of passion. It is a great sun, dispelling the darkness of the world's ignorance. It is fresh butter, churned from the milk of the true Dharma. For the caravan of famished beings, blundering on the road of existence, it is a banquet of joy, which refreshes completely all hunger for happiness. Today I invite the world to Buddhahood and to all the happiness of the Dhamma, May God's Titans and all rejoice.